Yeah, good morning, Your Honor, Sun Chen. May I please court? This is an insurance subrogation case. The underlying dispute is international shipping. And we contend in district court's ruling on partial summary judgment erroneously identified a person, which is Intac Limited, which is not a party of this action. And also, since it is the insurance subrogation action, only the insurance right is limited to what the subrogee's right. And in this case, the subrogee is Gila Trans California. So there's no case we can find that the district court can grant a judgment in favor of a non-party and against a party defendant, which is Top Sealand. So we believe that's a fundamental error because
Are you claiming that, you know, the paperwork wasn't done right, that the insured, you know, designates the person acting on its behalf, and then when the subrogation agreement was done, that wasn't done all correctly? What evidence do you have that shows that there was some sort of gap there and that the rights didn't land in the right hands?
Yes, in the insurance policy, the only person identified as insured is Pilar Tran, California. And in the subrogation agreement, it says very clearly insured is Pilar Tran. And there's nothing mentioned about Intac, which happened to be a constant need in the Top Sealand's bill of lading. So based on California law on insurance, only insured, the insurer can subrogate into it. And Intac is being mentioned in a certificate which is issued by Pilar Tran, but by itself, it doesn't translate into as insured.
Suppose we, you know, disagree with you on this particular point, and we think that a person who can exercise the rights is in fact in front of us. Tell us why you think you should, why you still should prevail.
Which person? You mean Pilar Tran?
So suppose we conclude that Atlantic Specialty is in fact the proper party to be asserting the rights against you. Tell us why you would think in that circumstance you would win on the merits.
Sure. Also, there's a three-day notice, and which is in the COXA, I believe Section 3, Subsection 6, which mandates the receiving party to notify the carrier if there's any damage. So the carrier can exercise its right to get a surveyor to find out what's the nature of damage. But that notice was not given to Top Sealand at all. In fact, the notice was given.
What would follow from the notice not being given is
right.
a prima facie assumption about the condition of the goods. But the district court's order, as I read it, and tell me if I'm wrong, seemed to entertain that presumption, but say there was abundant evidence to rebut it in the record, and therefore seems to have accepted the argument here, at least arguendo. So it really comes down to the point whether the district court was wrong about saying that there was abundant evidence to rebut it.
Actually, it was wrong because the court did not specify any evidence. The only time the damage was discovered is during final delivery to Forever 21. Which is on August, I believe, 25th.
Right, but the district court looked at what evidence was in the record about where it was and the conditions it was under between the point it left the port to when it arrived at the facility in August and said, you know, it didn't rain during that time. There's no evidence it was exposed to anything during it. So the district court seemed to take account of that in saying that any presumption arising from the notice issue was rebutted. Am I reading this wrong?
No, the problem is the ability to discover the nature of damage. That's triggered by three-day notice. And since we have no, Top Sealand has no notice, we cannot send a surveyor, a professional surveyor, to find out whether it is, how it is damaged, and more importantly, when it was damaged. If you can show that the fresh water, assuming it's fresh water, is damaged within up single is a month, because actually the arrival date is July 25th, and delivery date, I believe, is August 17th. So I think that's a critical issue. And also another critical issue is when the surveyor engaged by insurance company going to look at the goods, the container is no longer there. That's the issue of a chain of custody.
So there was an assertion that the notation of damages on the Yamco truck lines delivery receipt, that the cargo was rejected by Forever 21 was sufficient notice?
Oh, that's only notice of the damage, but not the degree of damages, because the cartons is stacked many layers. Actually, top layers from the picture is not damaged at all. So
you disagree that that evidence was sufficient to place all the parties on notice, including Sealand?
No, but the problem is that my client doesn't have a chance to inspect. And we also postponed discovery. And we also have no chance to find out exactly what's the nature of the damage to the garments. And also,
Collins said that because you had no opportunity to inspect, that you weren't maybe directly notified, what that did is create a presumption or a prima facie case that that you weren't, that there wasn't any damage during the course of the shipment. But ultimately, you had the evidence submitted to the district court that there was this damage and the damage was proven.
Okay, I think extent of damage is one issue, and also there's an equitable issue, because that's why we mentioned the Q clause. And the Cox side, there's a Q clause, because my client is a freight forwarder. Its job is to turn over the container to the ocean carrier, which is, in this case, Hamburg-Sud. Actually, there are two bills of lading, but the plaintiff choose to not to sue Hamburg-Sud, and instead sue my clients alone. Actually, I cannot find any single case, I mean, based on my ability to locate, that the damage issue, only the freight forwarder being held liable, but not the ocean carrier. Because my client turned over the container of goods, and it's non-disputed, it's in good condition. After that, my client is a freight forwarder, has no possession, no custody, no control of the merchandise. And right now, I think the issue is when, if it's damaged, when was damaged. And my client doesn't have the opportunity because the subrogee violated the mandatory rule to give a 3-day notice. So we cannot present evidence when the water seepage, if the water seepage is going into the goods. So I think, and
is there any third party discovery taken of the shipper, the boat operator?
Can I ask a question again?
Was there any third party discovery taken? I mean, you're saying that the shipping company was not a defendant, but was third party discovery taken of it as to what happened during the transit across the Pacific?
I think there's no way to. Okay, first of all, for upon discovery, we have no response. There's no, right now, nobody knows when the water seepage go into the container. And also, there's no evidence that when the container, why container caused these damages. And also, most importantly, we don't know when that damage occurred. So there's no way to find, and most importantly, my client should have his right to go in, inspect the goods directly, but that right totally being cut off. So eventually, when we try to do any discovery, the container is no longer there, the merchandise is no longer there, nothing is there. The only thing left is a couple of pictures.
Suppose that notice had been given. It was all caught at the port of Los Angeles when the container comes off and the goods are discovered to be damaged. Then what would happen? Then would you lose at that point?
I think that's a hypothetical, and which I think there's no evidence in support.
I know it's a hypothetical, yeah. But I want to understand what the applicable rules of law are. So in that circumstance, you get the notice, you discover right when the container is opened in the port of Los Angeles, it's all damaged. Are you then liable?
I think may not, because this is an equity case. I mean, this is a case in equity. Applying the Q clause, my client has no act, no omission, which can cause this damage. So by applying the equitable rules and applying the Q clause and the COXA, my client should not be held liable because it's not negligent in any way, even though if the goods is damaged.
And you don't think COGSA puts any burden on you in that kind of situation to establish an alternative cause?
Yeah, we have a burden if we have a chance to inspect. See, this is a circular argument presented by plaintiff. See, we did not present evidence, but the problem is we are totally deprived of any opportunity to discover any evidence because, like I said, containers.
Right, but that's why my hypothetical was to take the notice issue out of the case. If we didn't have the notice issue, would you then lose because COGSA puts a burden on you to show the alternative clause and you didn't carry it?
No, because then we apply the equity principle, look at the facts, like I said, look at the Q clause, which my client has no act, no omission, which will possibly lead to these damages. I think the only person more likely to cause damage may be the ocean carrier.
As to the Q clause, I believe one of the cases cited is Quaker Oats versus MV Torvanger, and the court held that the presumption of fault is not rebutted by simple proof of the carrier's own due diligence. For the Q clause to come into play, the carrier must first prove what the other cause was. Do you believe Quaker Oats applies in your case and would not support your position?
I don't believe exactly because, again, this is a subrogation action. We believe the equitable principle applies. So by applying equitable principle, I don't think we had to draw the assumption which is against my client.
So this equitable principle, what case is that derived from?
Which one?
You said these equitable principles. Are you relying upon the Q clause or something independent beyond that?
I think we said in the brief is in general because the subrogation case is where the equitable principle should apply because the subrogation is an equitable
Do you have a particular case that specifically is related to these sorts of issues that you rely upon?
Not directly related to the ocean shipping, but it's a general. I think I cited in the brief that the equitable principle applies to subrogation cases.
Counsel, you have the district court awarded the damages for the mitigation efforts, and do you want to tell me why you shouldn't be liable for the mitigation damages?
Because I believe that the purpose of the statute is to make the plaintiff whole. And by providing the fair market value to the plaintiff, they already recovered everything they lost.
Did they have a duty to try to mitigate damages?
Yes, they do.
Okay. If they have a duty to mitigate damages and they spend money trying to mitigate damages and it's not successful, then they're out that money. Are they able to recoup that from your client?
That should not be recruited from us because that means they being compensated more than the fair value of the merchandise.
But I'm sorry, I didn't understand that.
The reason because by adding another remediation cost, it will go beyond what they are compensated for because they are only entitled to compensate to a degree of damages.
Right, but if the law imposes a duty to mitigate damages.
Right.
And the mitigation efforts cost more than they're able to save, then they're going to be out additional money that the law apparently requires them to spend. The insurance company has paid for that. Why shouldn't they be able to recoup that from your client?
I think that's the factual issue, too, whether that mitigation was justified. Because our contention is that the most of merchandise are not damaged. The mitigation effort to clean up the damage should restore the merchandise to original position. If that's the case, then the plaintiff should not be entitled to the market value at all because the goods is not damaged.
Right, but the mitigation efforts here were not successful.
Yeah, but if it's not successful, I think that's a jury finding, I think.
But what's your authority as a legal matter for the proposition that they're not allowed to obtain more than the value of goods and cannot recover the reasonable costs of mitigation efforts that prove to be unsuccessful? What authority says that they can't get that and that it's capped in the way you say?
I'm not sure there's any case directly, but on the other hand, there's also no case that plaintiffs are entitled to market value plus any failure of mitigation. I don't believe that's the case either. I don't believe any case is directly on point in either way.
Right. But from their perspective, they can't be made whole. The law imposes on them an obligation to mitigate, and they do their best.
No, but the problem is the equitable conduct, because the evidence shows that a lot of merchandise are not damaged. They could take those merchandise, and instead of the court giving the
okay. Well, that's just a factual dispute, right? That's not. You're not contesting the principle about recovering the mitigation costs. You're arguing you shouldn't have gotten it in this case because the goods weren't actually damaged as badly as Forever 21 thought they were.
Against the equitable principle that the plaintiff is allowed to recover both the market value and the mitigation cost. The mitigation is that they had to do something at their own risk. If they made a poor judgment, I think they should be responsible for their loss. That's my understanding. Because otherwise, so why should the defendant be punished for paying both the market value plus the failure of so-called failure of mitigation? Because we believe that could be avoided, or that should totally eliminate the compensation of the market value because the mitigation efforts should have been
successful. If we adopted your rule, counsel, that would shift the cost of mitigation or the risk of mitigation efforts not going well to the owner of the goods. And that means that in the future, a company like Forever 21 will say, well, we got burned last time. We're just going to declare it a total loss, and we're not going to try to mitigate. Then your client would have grounds to come and say, well, that's not fair. The damages aren't as bad as you say they are. I mean, we have to cut one way or the other here, counsel.
I think that's the issue of reasonableness. I believe that's the more issue.
Well, but again, if your argument is that these efforts, the mitigation efforts here were not reasonable, that would be for the fact finder to determine whether these were reasonable efforts. But the question here is if they have a legal obligation to engage in mitigation and it is unsuccessful, who bears the risk of that?
I believe that the plaintiff should bear that cost because otherwise it will be totally inequitable. It will be punish the defendant because the defendant will be borne two costs. And in this case particularly, equity pointed out, the defendant is totally not at fault because we have no control over the merchandise. We are in no way responsible for the damage if there's any of the merchandise.
All right. Thank you, counsel. Yeah. We've taken you over, but I'll give you 2 minutes for rebuttal.
Okay.
All right. So we'll hear now from Mr. Tabrisky.
May it please the court. My name is Joe Tabrisky, and I represent Atlantic Specialty Insurance Company. I'd like to, since we are on a cross appeal, I'd like to reserve 2 minutes to answer any questions.
No, there's no okay. Reserval of time on cross appeal. You do it all now.
All right. That's fine. Thank you, Your Honor. To address, I'm going to address mainly the questions that I heard Judge Bybee and Judge Collins, you raised.
Can you first just address the threshold question and explain why, in your view, there's no issue about the right party being in front of us?
Very simply, there was a certificate of insurance issued, much like you would do with any other carrier. For example, household goods. You go to a household goods trucker and they say we want to transport it from A to B, and the trucker says, do you have insurance? They can issue a certificate of insurance and you're covered under the policy. Pillar Trans here had the authority through its broker to issue an insurance, a certificate of insurance. That certificate of insurance insured Intech for its risk of loss while the cargo was in transit. The evidence was, including at the time of trial, Mrs. Sim, who was the managing director of Pillar Trans, indicated that upon receipt of the funds, the $108,000 paid by Atlantic Specialty, that she conveyed the net sum to Intech less the sue and labor that Pillar Trans had incurred in trying to do the mitigation damages or mitigate the loss, so that in fact Intech received the funds, were subrogated to the rights of Intech during the transit. Intech had the risk of loss all through transit, so we're the proper party under the certificate of insurance. And the certificate of insurance was properly pled. It identified Intech as the insured. We pled it in the first amended complaint. It was evidence used at the time of the summary judgment, also evidence at the time of trial. So there wasn't any question, really, that we were the proper party. The second question as to mitigation. Yes.
Do you have what was interesting? I mean, this is not an unusual fact pattern in shipping, and shipping is not a reason. recent technological innovation. Is there no case, one way or another, that squarely addresses the issue of the recoverability of reasonable mitigation efforts that failed in contract cases?
Most certainly in the Ninth Circuit, we haven't seen it.
But even in the statesism, by common law analogy, is there nothing?
In context of contract law, absolutely mitigation is always a recoverable damage in straight contract cases, whether it's whatever state you happen to be in. It's basic. What we indicated
Did you cite any of that kind of authority in your
brief? I cited authority in the brief relating to the basic contract damages, relating to mitigation, also the
deference. But that specifically held that you can recover reasonable mitigation costs that fail.
Yes.
Yes. What case did you cite for that proposition? Yes.
In re Kellett Aircraft Corp. 186 F. 2nd, 197, 198 to 199, 3rd Circuit, 1950, Federal Insurance Company versus Sabine, S-A-B-I-N-E, Towing and Transportation Company, 783 F. 2nd, 347 and 350, 2nd Circuit, 1986. The quote was, "Where choice has been required between two reasonable courses, the person who's wrong forced the choice cannot complain that one rather than the other was chosen. The rule of mitigation damages may not be invoked by a contract breaker as a basis for hypercritical examination of the conduct of the injured party or merely for the purpose of showing that the injured person might have taken steps which seemed wiser or would have been more advantageous to the defaulter." And the other one is Tennessee Valley Sand and Gravel Company versus MV Delta, 598 F2nd 930. And in that case, the fact that his efforts turn out to be unsuccessful and actually increase the loss does not preclude recovery for all expenses incurred in the process. Now, in this particular instance, Intech was the middleman, and it bore the risk. It wanted the contract to go forward. This wasn't Forever 21 making the decision. It wanted this contract to proceed, so it did what it could to mitigate the damages and at least get something from Forever 21 for these goods. It failed. So it can't be said that they are going to be harmed, that they should be lose the right of recovering those damages simply because of there's an invoice price when they're trying to mitigate. They're trying to do what they can to reduce the expenses. Now, the other reason that mitigation here should be kept in mind is the other thing that the court failed to account for was the salvage. It was sold for $6,000 in its somewhat damaged state. And what did mitigation do to increase that salvage value? I mean, if they hadn't mitigated anything and they just said, "We're going to salvage this and it's $1,000 or it's cloth scrap or whatever." No, they put the effort out. They tried to reduce the damages. It didn't work. They salvaged it. The court didn't even account for the salvage. So in our view, and the court didn't say anything about this being an unreasonable attempt to mitigate. It didn't attempt to say that any of the expenses were somehow outside the realm of what a normal damage case would be. The court made a decision of law, so this court can instruct it to say, no, those are recoverable damages, and you also need to account for the salvage, taking us to the $91,000, roughly $91,000 that should have been awarded. So that takes us to the next step, which is the prejudgment interest. And on the prejudgment interest, Again, excuse me. Neither party at any time up through trial argued 28 U.S.C. 1961 prejudgment interest rate. Because the Bill of Lading incorporated state law.
No, but we have a case that says that the statute which prescribes the post-judgment interest rate will be applied as the prejudgment interest rate in admiralty law unless equitable circumstances indicate otherwise. So that made the statute highly pertinent, even if neither side cited it.
I agree, Your Honor, to some extent it does make it pertinent, but it also says that it talks about the cases, whether it's Western Pacific Fisheries or Columbia Brickworks, also talked about appropriate and use that term. 0.07 on the date of the incident, August 17th.
The interest rates were low at that time.
But the court, again, Your Honor, when you look at, for example, the Supreme
10% is not a market rate. That's a really good rate if you can get that. That's a
0.07%?
10%, which is the rate you want, the statutory California rate. Is above market under the conditions. Why isn't it inequitable to apply that? I mean, this is a federal law question, isn't it?
Yes and no. But remember, the Supreme Court held in Great Lakes that the parties could adopt, could choose the law to apply.
No, right, but did it say that with respect to an issue where there is a federal statute on point?
1961 isn't on point. It's post-judgment, not pre-judgment.
Well, that's correct. But we have, as we're binding Ninth Circuit precedent, says that as a matter of substantive admiralty law, we will borrow that as the applicable rate of interest unless the circumstances indicate otherwise.
And the circumstances should indicate otherwise, because if you're talking about, remember, one of the other things that the Ninth Circuit said was that if you do it so low that it's in the interest of the defendant just to sit back and let and just keep stalling, then there is a then you're not accomplishing a compensation to the plaintiff, and that's what's been going on here. There's no ability for us to compel the defendant to be reasonable because the defendant can sit back and do nothing at 0.07%. We're looking at a few hundred dollars over a four-year period that have been accumulated on roughly $91,000 in losses. Now, again, going back to the Ninth Circuit has never addressed the question of a choice of law in the context of prejudgment interest. In other contexts, for example, attorney's fees, as it relates to a bill of lading, the Ninth Circuit has addressed it and applied foreign law. Here we have the carrier's own bill of lading adopting California state law. The loss occurred in California. The cargo was delivered in California. In terms of policies and in terms of equities, which the Ninth Circuit referred to in Western Pacific and as well as in Columbia Brickworks, it points to the application of the state law rate over the 0.07 that was under 1961. Otherwise, we are imprinting on 1961 and making it the default prejudgment interest. And that's not what the Ninth Circuit said. It said where appropriate. Even in certain circumstances, the Ninth Circuit said that the court could adopt the state rate if it was lower than the market rate, if it was appropriate. So here we have a situation where none of the court, neither Western Pacific Fisheries nor Columbia Brickworks addressed the question of what do you do when the Bill of Lading incorporates the law of the port of delivery, and that law is adopted by the carrier in its bill of lading. And in this situation, it's compensable to the plaintiff to incorporate the state rate that the carrier incorporated into its bill of lading. Now, I think, unless there are other questions that the court has on the subjects, I think at this point I have nothing further. Do you have any other questions?
All right. Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
All right. We'll hear rebuttal.
To address opposing counsel's a couple of points. The first one is on mitigation. I think he cited a case which is Tennessee Valley Sand and Gravel Company. But in that case, the court awarded the mitigation damages but did not mention any other compensation. So that case by itself does not present the argument that opposing counsel is presenting, that a plaintiff could be entitled to both market value and mitigation damages. And as far as the prejudgment interest, I think the bill of lading also at the beginning of paragraph 21 states, except is otherwise provided specifically herein, which means that the choice of law clause doesn't even apply because this case based on the bill of lading is governed by federal law. It's not governed by state law. So, and also to avoid prejudgment interest, I believe there's an equitable consideration. As I mentioned earlier, there's a lot of inequitable conduct.
I mean, why is this really governed by federal law? Because it's a matter of federal law, what rate of interest applies to a federal judgment once it's entered. But the calculation of damages and prejudgment interest is part of a calculation of damages, is governed by the substantive law that applies, and there's a choice of law provision. So why shouldn't that be used as the rule then?
Because I believe calculating damages is part of caucus's function, and which is the federal law. And also there's an equitable consideration in applied prejudgment interest. I think in this case, I believe that the equitable is much in favor of a defendant because due to a lot of inequitable conduct, as I mentioned earlier. And also under California law, to apply a prejudgment interest, which is in the Civil Code 3284, and the damage prejudgment interest is available only when the amount of damage is certain. And this case is not certain at all, because it requires the fact finder to calculate, to determine the market value, and also that's to determine amount of damages. So since the amount of damages is absolutely not certain, it's, under California laws, prejudgment interest should not be applied.
All right.
Actually, that's the case.
All right. Thank you, counsel. The case just argued will be submitted,
okay.
And the court will stand in recess for 5 minutes.